Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Indian Tribal Court Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 23, 2016, the Supreme Court decided Dollar General Corporation v. Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians. This case concerns a dispute over tribal court jurisdiction relating to allegations that the non-Indian manager of a Dollar General store on Choctaw tribal land sexually molested an Indian minor who interned at the store. When the minor's parents sought to hold Dolgan Corp., the subsidiary that operated the store, vicariously liable for the manager's conduct, Dolgan Corp. petitioned in federal district court for an injunction barring tribal court proceedings on the grounds that the tribal court lacked jurisdiction. The district court denied relief, concluding that while tribal courts typically lack civil authority over the conduct of non-members on non-Indian land within a reservation, Dolgan Corp.'s situation fell within a consensual relationship exception to the rule. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit affirmed and denied rehearing en banc over the dissent of five judges. The question before the Supreme Court was whether Indian tribal courts have jurisdiction to adjudicate civil tort claims against non-members, including as a means of regulating the conduct of non-members who enter into consensual relationships with a tribe or its members. In a per curiam opinion, the judgment of the Fifth Circuit was affirmed by an equally divided court. To discuss the case, we have Zachary Price, who is an associate professor of law at University of California, Hastings College of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Price.
As you know, I'm here to discuss the Supreme Court's decision in Dollar General Corporation versus the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians. I'd say decision, but in fact, of course, there really wasn't any decision in this case. This was one of the cases in which the Supreme Court split 4-4 following Justice Scalia's death. That means the court, in fact, issued no opinion in the case, instead affirmed by an equally divided vote. That means the lower court's decision stands. There's no precedential ruling on the legal question that was before the Supreme Court from the Supreme Court itself. I think the case is nonetheless worth talking about because if it had come out the other way, it would have been a very big deal for federal Indian law. So what I want to try to do in this podcast is provide a bit of background about the case and about the federal Indian law principles implicated. My own view, for what it's worth, is that the lower court got it right in this case and that reversing would have taken the court down a bad path. But this is an issue like so many others, where the views of the justice who eventually replaces Scalia may matter a great deal. And frankly, unlike many other issues, it's an issue that may not be on everyone's radar and on which it may be quite likely that the new nominee, in fact, has no well-developed view going in. So why is Dollar General a big deal? What is the issue in the case? So factually, the case involved a nationwide chain of retail stores. The chain opened a store on lands controlled by the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians. The store's manager agreed to participate in a tribal, quote, youth opportunity program, a program that placed young tribal members in local internships. The manager then allegedly molested a 13-year-old participant in the youth program at the store. So the victim is now suing Dollar General for tort damages. He alleges theories of vicarious liability and negligent failure to train and supervise. But the legal issue that made its way to the Supreme Court arises because the victim chose to bring this tort suit not in state or federal court, but instead in the tribal courts of the Mississippi Choctaw, so in courts established by the tribe as an exercise of its own governmental authority. So the basic legal question that was before the Supreme Court is whether tribal courts, meaning courts established by a Native American nation in this way, can exercise this type of tort jurisdiction. So tort jurisdiction over a business like Dollar General that is owned and operated by people who are not necessarily members of the tribe or indeed members of any Native American tribe. Now that may sound fairly dry and technical, but in fact, at the beginning, it implicates some very basic issues in federal Indian law. So let me try and explain what's at stake in the broader picture. Modern federal Indian law is really organized around two basic premises. the first premise is that the tribes are sovereign entities in the United States. They have sovereign power, much like a state or the federal government. Where does this come from? Well, tribes, of course, were here first. They were the sovereign entities in North America before colonization and the founding expansion of the United States. So one basic premise of federal Indian law as it has developed is that tribes retain some inherent sovereignty, some inherent governmental authority by virtue of their pre-constitutional existence as sovereign entities in North America. Tribes care a great deal about this principle. They view themselves as sovereign local governments, and they want to be treated that way by other governments. So that's the first premise, this notion of inherent sovereignty. The second premise of federal Indian law, though, which is arguably in some tension with the first, is that Congress, nonetheless, has, quote, plenary authority over Native American tribes. Now, where exactly this power comes from is not clear. One of the things that makes federal Indian law a difficult and troubling area of law is, of course, it implicates our country's appalling abuse of Native peoples throughout much of its history. And in fact, the Supreme Court embraced this plenary power doctrine in the late 19th century during a low point in the country's treatment of Native Americans. But nonetheless, for better or for worse, at least for the time being, this doctrine remains a cornerstone of federal Indian law, and the modern cases tend to associate it with the so-called Indian Commerce Clause, which in fact says only that Congress can regulate commerce, quote, with the Indian tribes, but that's been taken to entail this broader authority over tribal affairs. So in any event, putting those two premises together, the upshot is of the plenary power doctrine as it relates to inherent tribal sovereignty is that Congress has the authority ultimately to abolish or regulate or restore exercises or the scope of tribal government power more or less as it sees fit. So the basic framework is that tribes have this inherent sovereignty, but then Congress has plenary authority to take it away or regulate how it's exercised. Okay, so that's the basic framework in which Dollar General fits. Now, the next piece is how this case fits into a trajectory of case law from the Supreme Court. As I said, in the past, Congress exercised its plenary power in very troubling ways, but in recent decades, both Congress and the executive branch have generally supported tribal self-determination. They've wanted tribes to be more effective local governments. But the Supreme Court has thrown a bit of a wrench in the works, because while the political branches have generally supported tribal authority, the Supreme Court has pushed back in a controversial series of federal common law cases. In these cases, the court has held that even without any particular statute divesting tribes of jurisdiction, in other words, even without any explicit exercise of Congress's plenary power, the tribes' very incorporation into the United States has, quote, implicitly divested them of certain aspects of sovereignty with respect to people who aren't members of the tribe. So in effect, the Supreme Court has established a set of default common law rules about when tribes can exercise authority over non-members, at least insofar as Congress doesn't override those default rules. So Dollar General would have been the next case in this line. Dollar General was arguing for implicit divestiture. It was saying that by virtue of incorporating Native American nations into the United States, even without any explicit legislation to this effect, Congress implicitly divested the tribes of tort jurisdiction over non-Native defendants, non-Native entities. So had this argument prevailed, it would have cut back in quite significant ways on the jurisdiction that tribes believed they could exercise under prior case law. In particular, one previous case called Montana versus the United States, the Supreme Court had said that tribes could exercise civil governmental authority over, quote, the activities of non-members who enter consensual relationships with the tribe or its members through commercial dealing, contracts, leases, or other arrangements. So in effect, if that notion of consent to jurisdiction, consensual relationships, covered anything beyond an express contractual acceptance of tribal jurisdiction, the facts of Dollar General would have seemed to fall squarely within it. So the prior case law seemed to favor tribal authority. But then presumably four justices on the Supreme Court would have held otherwise, would have held some more explicit consent to tribal jurisdiction if necessary. So why? What is their perspective, and why? What's driving that perspective on the case? So just briefly, in past cases in an oral argument, in this case, the four more conservative justices and some other justices in the past have expressed the concern that tribal courts are going to be structurally biased against non-members. Tribal membership is generally defined by blood. As a result, non-members, even if they live on reservations, may never be able to participate fully in tribal government. And what's more, tribes may have customs and traditions that are quite different from Anglo-American legal traditions. And under current law, at least, there's no direct review of tribal court decisions in the U.S. Supreme Court or any other court, nor is there an opportunity for a non-member defendant to remove a case to federal or state court in the way that a state defendant can sometimes remove a case to federal court. So the four more conservative justices presently on the court have worried that this structure creates a significant risk of unfairness, possibly even of constitutional dimension. So as a result, these justices have often voted in the past to cut back on tribes' authority to exercise power over non-members in the first place, and in all likelihood would have done so in some form in this case as well. Now, just to offer my own perspective, I think there may be some force to this type of concern in some circumstances, but I don't find it particularly compelling here. There's no indication that the Mississippi Choctaw courts are behaving unfairly. On the contrary, they seem to be something of a model of tribal justice. What's more, the tribe has powerful incentives to maintain credible courts. If its courts are perceived to have treated defendants like Dollar General unfairly, other businesses will presumably be much less likely to make investments on tribal lands in the future. And in addition, if the tribal court enters a large judgment in the plaintiff's favor, the plaintiffs will probably have to enforce that judgment against off-reservation assets. And while state and federal courts generally enforce tribal court judgments as a matter of comedy, they can refuse to do so. They sometimes refuse to do so in the past if the tribal proceedings were egregiously unfair. And furthermore, first part, Dollar General looks pretty bad in this case. It deliberately sought the benefits of tribal jurisdiction, but now wants to avoid the burdens. And if the allegations are true, it doesn't seem to me there's any grave injustice in requiring the company to answer to tribal institutions for this quite appalling tort that occurred on tribal land. But in any event, as I said at the outset, these issues are likely to find their way back to the Supreme Court eventually. That means that on this issue, as on so many others, the views of Justice Scalia's eventual replacement will play a big role in shaping the future development of this important area of federal law.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.